Good afternoon. Go ahead and be seated. All right. Our last case of the day is docket number 66459, Pompey versus Clarkson. Are we ready to proceed?
Yes, Your Honor.
All right.
Clifford Gravett, appearing on behalf of Appellant Lori Pompey. And this case, ultimately, Your Honors, is about one overarching legal issue. Whether insolvent corporations and the creditors of insolvent corporations under Nevada law have any protections and any ability to protect themselves in the Nevada court. And the two legal issues that the court is called to decide today are, first, whether creditors of insolvent corporations have derivative standing to bring claims on behalf of an insolvent corporation. And we request today that the court hold that Nevada does follow this legal doctrine and remand this case accordingly. The second legal issue that the court is called upon to decide is whether Nevada follows the so-called trust fund theory, which holds that when a corporation becomes insolvent, its directors become trustees of the corporate assets for the benefit of creditors who are therefore beneficiaries. And the third issue the court is called upon to decide is whether there were erroneous findings of fact from the district court, chief among which was actually a finding of fact that should have been made but wasn't, which is the solvency or insolvency of Old Premier at the time the factual issues complained of occurred. And I'll turn first to the derivative standing issue. Diwala and its progeny, as cited in our brief, stands for the proposition, as I previously stated, that when a corporation becomes insolvent, its creditors gain standing to bring derivative claims on the corporation's behalf. And the reason for this policy, as numerous courts have indicated, is that when a corporation is insolvent, under law, the creditors step to the front of the line, so to speak, and they, instead of the shareholders, have the full rights to the corporate residue. Thus, the creditors, rather than the shareholders, are the parties most likely and most aligned with the corporate interest of maximizing the corporate value. And should the court follow Giwala and its progeny, what would be the result in this case? Well, we have alleged, or Lori has alleged, that the appellants, who I'll refer to as the Clarkson defendant, the attorney appellant, committed malpractice against their client, Premier Properties Inc., which I'll refer to as Old Premier, in the discussions, the preparation, the negotiations, and the completion of an asset transfer from Old Premier to an entity wholly owned by the Clarkson entities, which I'll refer to as New Premier. The claim is held exclusively by Old Premier, on whose behalf the derivative claim was alleged. The damages, if any, will ultimately be recovered by Old Premier, not by Lori. And most of all, and this is where the appellees took most issue with our appeal and down at the trial court, there will not be any assertion, and there is not any assertion, that as a matter of professional duty or professional obligation between the Clarkson defendant and Lori, there was none. She was not the client. And it's not her that is asserting this claim. She is merely standing up as the derivative claimant, a creditor of an insolvent corporation, to raise the malpractice claim on Old Premier's behalf. So it will not lead, the courts allowing the malpractice claim to go forward will not lead to any chilling of attorney-client relationships or a twilight zone where attorneys owe duties to their litigation opponents, because that's simply not what we're asking for.
Let me ask you this. Just as you're talking about derivative claims, does it make any difference whether it was a direct claim or a derivative claim for her to have standing
to bring the claim in the first instance? And are you referring to the malpractice claim specifically?
Yes.
Well, I think it does make a difference because we don't think that there was any malpractice as between the Clarkson defendants and Lori. They didn't owe her any duty. But as between the Clarkson defendants and Old Premier, there was a duty. So if she had tried to bring this malpractice claim as a direct claim where the duty was allegedly owed to her, then I don't think we even would have gotten out of the gate.
And it becomes an issue, and it wasn't specifically addressed below. It becomes a jurisdictional issue if there's no standing.
Absolutely.
The question becomes whether it was a waiver or not. But this court can, on its own, look at jurisdictional issues. So I'm kind of interested in that issue.
As to whether the court would have jurisdiction if the claim had been raised directly rather than derivatively?
Well, whether or not she had a derivative claim, because she didn't claim she had a derivative claim, right?
Chief Justice Perry-Gary, I disagree. I think that the pleading in the First Amended Complaint was very clear that the duties of care were owed to, as to the malpractice claim,
okay,
were owed to Old Premier, and that the damages from the malpractice accrue to Old Premier. And so if she doesn't have standing to raise the malpractice claim derivatively on behalf of Old Premier, then I'll concede that there's no other claim. There's certainly not a direct malpractice claim on behalf of Lori Palmer.
Thank you.
And that kind of takes me to the direct claims, because there certainly was a class of claims which were directly pled, and that was those arising out of the so-called trust fund theory, which, as I stated, is this idea that when a corporation is insolvent, the directors are trustees of the assets and owe duties to the creditors. Now, these fiduciary duties, even states that have adopted this doctrine, and as the federal courts have predicted that this state will, it's not a full list of the standard fiduciary duties that a trustee would owe to a beneficiary, and we're not claiming that that's the case. Rather, it's the basic duties that corporate directors owe, the duty to avoid self-dealing or to refrain from self-dealing, the duty to refrain from insider transfers, the duty to maximize the corporate value, and the duty to treat the class, in this case the creditors, fairly. And the evidence that we submitted to the district court was clear that there were at least issues of fact as to the breach of each of those duties. There was an asset transfer that took place, and based on the books of Old Premier, there was over $200,000, or approximately $200,000, that these directors owed to their corporation, Old Premier, that disappeared off the books. It didn't make it in the transfer, wasn't forgiven, wasn't paid off, it just disappeared. So that, we submit, was evidence of self-dealing. The second, transfer to insiders, as we set forth in the brief, and as I won't belabor, general counsel, at least in some cases, is an insider because they have the inside track to the director's table. They can go to the directors and negotiate payment and transfers that your standard arm's-length creditors, and particularly judgment creditors, just can't do. And that's the reason why insider transfers are disfavored.
Should we have any concern as to the failure of the court to talk about the insolvency and the asset transfer?
Absolutely. I think that that's a critical issue, Justice Cherry, because, I'm sorry, Justice Douglas, I'm very nervous.
He mixes up all the time.
Justice Douglas, I apologize. It is the critical finding of fact, because if Old Premier was solvent when the asset transfer was discussed and structured and ultimately took place, then we don't have any claims. If it was solvent under the balance sheet test or whichever test the court adopts, then there aren't any claims. But if it was insolvent, then these two legal doctrines, derivative standing and the trust fund theory, spring into existence on their own, and the duties arose. And so ultimately, the failure to make that finding, which would have triggered the appropriate legal analysis, on its own was error that at this point I would say mandates a redo by the court on this issue. Now, able counsel is going to stand up right after me and say that this is all about one attorney that didn't get paid, my firm, upset about attorneys that did get paid, Mr. Clarkson's firm. And that's not what this is about. It's simply not the case. Attorneys can certainly get paid, but when their clients are insolvent corporations, there are minimal duties that they have to abide by and minimal steps that they have to take to ensure that their client is not harmed in this payment scheme. And number one, the district court didn't even get to the issue of whether those duties were breached. And number two, we submit that they were, and that the malpractice that resulted deserves a remedy. Thank you, and I'll reserve my remit.
All right, thank you.
A question, Chief Justice.
Any questions?
No, fine.
No, we're okay.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you. Okay, Mr. Hayward.
Good afternoon, Justices, and may it please the Court. Dan Hayward of Flaxalt and Lemura on behalf of Respondents Barry Clarkson and Clarkson, Draper, and Beckstrom. With me today is Rick Hawes, who is in pro per at council table. I believe that I'll be taking most or all of the time. If that's agreeable, it is agreeable to Mr. Hawes. Just by way of very brief background, because I do think it is important, Ms. Pompei, the appellant, sued Premier, Inc. and Doug Reed in his capacity as a broker, not in his capacity as a director or any kind of trustee. My clients, through attorney Steve Beckstrom, who was formerly a party but is no longer, represented Premier, Inc. and Mr. Reed in his capacity as a director only. A verdict was obtained by Ms. Pompei against Premier, Inc. and on March 13th of 2009 for $65,000 in commissions. And then she was awarded an additional $160,000 in attorney's fees and costs, which truly is what brings us here today, Your Honors, because she's recovered settlements well in excess of the $65,000 in commissions she was awarded. We're here because her attorneys have nowhere else to go to try to get their bill paid because Premier, Inc. is dissolved, Mr. Reith, the broker, is bankrupt, has been through a bankruptcy, so they're now suing the other former director, Mr. Hawes, and the lawyers who represented their client's former adversary in the underlying litigation. Now, Ms. Pompei proceeded to do virtually nothing with her judgment as far as execution attempts for nearly 18 months until she finally noticed the debtor's exam of Mr. Reith in September of 2010, and he declared bankruptcy shortly thereafter. Now, meanwhile, my clients, understandably, wanted to be paid for their work, and as my colleague pointed out, lawyers are entitled to be paid. The client had no real cash with which to satisfy what everyone seems to agree, or at least not take issue with, is a bona fide debt in excess of $100,000. So my clients worked out a creative but not prohibited transaction with Premier, Inc. to satisfy that debt. And that's all laid out in the briefs, and I won't belabor that point. After Premier LLC, the new entity, acquired the assets, and understandably, as most folks would after an asset purchase, wanted to put those to work, generating income as an actual going concern as a real estate business. They kept the phone number, the location. They did use the name with the real estate division's blessing, Premier Properties of Mesquite, LLC, for name recognition purposes, and proceeded to go into business. Now, I would note that the value of the assets, the listing agreements, the agent agreements that were purchased by Premier LLC, the value of some of those parts is greater than the parts themselves. You couldn't, like a pile of cash, parcel out those assets to multiple creditors and have them be worth anything. This was not a situation in which, as I said, a pile of money could be divided easily among two creditors, Ms. Pompei and the firm. Now, between the date of the verdict and the dissolution of Premier, Inc. on June 18th of 2009, four key things happened other than the asset sale. The first was Richard Hawes resigned as a director and conveyed his shareholder interest in Premier, Inc. to his partner, Mr. Reith. He testified to that, and in the appendix we have the certificate of dissolution which was signed by Mr. Reith alone and indicates that Mr. Hawes and Mr. Reith were officers, but only lists Mr. Reith as a director, despite the fact that there's another line that was blank for a second director and clear instructions that all directors have to be indicated on the form. The only admissible evidence is that he had resigned as a director both before the dissolution and before the transfer. So for that reason, Your Honors, insolvency is not a critical fact in this case. Mr. Hawes had resigned before the transfer occurred. Now, another thing that happened is Mr. Clarkson referred Mr. Reith, the remaining director of Premier, Inc., to a bankruptcy and debtor's attorney, Matthew Johnson, as evidenced by the billing records of my client, the firm, dated April 1st of 2009. There was other counsel in the picture at the time this transaction was being discussed. Third, Mr. Reith, the remaining director, considered and decided to reject an April 10th, 2009 unsigned proposal from a competing brokerage in Mesquite, Consolidated Brokers ERA. Now, the opposing side says that that had a value of $350,000, $350,000. In fact, it was $10,000 cash that was proposed, and the ability to potentially earn out through sharing commissions for a period of time up to a maximum of $350,000. Now, Mr. Reith, being a real estate professional in that very community for a number of years and knowing what he was doing, he estimated the value of that deal at about $50,000, and accordingly he decided not to take that deal on behalf of the company, and instead to take, if you will, $75,000 in accounts receivable that were assigned from the firm down to Premier LLC and transferred to Premier Inc. In exchange for the assets of the company, the listing agreements, the agents, the furniture, and a place to work, essentially.
Was Mr. Hawes individually liable to the law firm? Like, did he sign a guarantee?
Mr. Reith, you mean, Your Honor?
Hawes or Reith, anybody?
Oh, Mr. Hawes, I don't believe there's any evidence that he had any individual relationship with my clients whatsoever, other than at one point he was a director of the corporate client in the underlying case.
But as a director, did he sign anything that would make him liable to the law firm?
Individually liable for the bills? I'm not aware of any guarantee. I hate to give you a definitive answer when I don't know the universe.
What about Reith? Did he sign anything? In other words, I'm just trying to find out if there's an issue maybe as to the smell test here.
Oh, I understand. Well, Mr. Reith was defended by the law firm in his capacity as a broker, because he was sued individually as a broker. And my understanding was he was also liable for some fees, a lesser amount to the firm. But the $75,000 in debt forgiveness that was exchanged for the assets, my understanding that represented Premier Inc.'s bill, if you will. There was this other issue with a Circleville Properties LLC, that owns some property in Utah. That interest in that LLC was exchanged for the other $25,000 of the total $100,000 bill. My understanding is that that $25,000 was a joint obligation of Mr. Reith and Premier Inc.
Where did Ms. Pompey get the money? What entity paid Ms. Pompey? You said that she got the $65,000.
There was a garnishment proceeding, ultimately, against Premier LLC, the new entity that received the asset. And as a result of a resolution of that case, there was $125,000 over time settlement by Premier LLC. Not all of that was paid, because another defendant in this case that got out and got an award fees came in and took some of the stream of payments. But over $100,000, I understand, was paid, well in excess of the $65,000 in commissions that she recovered in the underlying trial. So
her counsel did get some money.
I don't know who took what for sure, but mathematics would suggest that's the case.
So we can ask him on.
Yes,
he's got 5 minutes on rebuttal or whatever. 4 minutes.
Now, Your Honor, the other issue, this missing account receivable of Premier Inc., this missing note came up in counsel's discussion, and that's the fourth thing I wanted to discuss. Marissa Carter, the CPA for Premier Inc., was deposed, and the key parts of her deposition are in the appendix at pages 1194 to 1197. She discusses the fact, under oath, that several years prior, two individuals from California had loaned Premier Inc. about $200,000 for the company to use to buy out a third shareholder, Richard Anderson, who's not involved in this case. The company had an accounts payable to those two individuals in California. Hawes and Reith assumed that accounts payable because they had a relationship with those gentlemen and felt bad about them not getting paid, presumably. And in exchange for them assuming that accounts payable on behalf of the company, they were forgiven some debt that they owed the company. So rather than self-dealing or then walking away or from some obligations, they actually assumed countervailing obligations through journal entries, as testified to by the CPA, Ms. Carter, and as in the appendix. So there's no missing notes. There's no self-dealing here. There's also an issue about attorneys as insiders, and they cite a 1949 Ninth Circuit case, In re Heath, that talked about attorneys, physicians, relatives being insiders. Attorneys can be insiders, but in that case, they were talking about the context of, quote, a conveyance with a secret reservation. I'm about to go into bankruptcy, so I sell my cousin my house for a dollar, and when it's all said and done, he sells it back to me for a dollar, that kind of thing. I remain in control of my property. I get secret kickbacks from the buyer, that kind of thing. Here, there's absolutely no evidence of anything like that whatsoever. There was none at the summary judgment level. There's none now on de novo review. Your Honor, I would like to talk about specifically the fiduciary duty claim against Mr. Hawes. Under NRS 78590, directors become trustees over money and other property remaining upon dissolution of a corporation. At the time of dissolution here, there were no assets of the company. There had been a prior transaction. Well, their point then is we should adopt this trust fund theory, which basically gives pre-dissolution-like effect or obligations to directors, that if a company becomes insolvent under one test or another, that the directors then assume an equitable status as trustees over the assets of the company for the benefit of creditors. And that is an old doctrine that arose in about 1824, I think, in a federal case in Maine. It is used in many states throughout the country. This court has talked about it from a historical perspective in the Beezer Holmes case, and again in the Lamb case. But every time this court has addressed it, it has conveyed a sense that it would adopt, if it did, it would adopt a moderate or somewhat conservative view of the trust fund theory, where directors of insolvent corporations become trustees only to the extent they receive property or money of the company. And an analogy I saw in a Delaware case in preparing for today was the captain of the ship, when the ship is going down, he doesn't necessarily have to go down with the ship, but he can't push the passengers out of the way and take the lifeboat. And that makes perfect sense. Here, that's not what happened, though. The captain of the ship, Mr. Reith, had two passengers. He had my clients, who were owed money, and Ms. Pompey, who became a judgment creditor. Well, Ms. Pompey was basically sleeping below decks, doing nothing about her judgment, while my clients were taking efforts to be paid, as counsel admitted they are entitled to do. They took the lifeboat, the assets of the company, which weren't really divisible anyway, as I explained, because their only value is to the extent they can be aggregated and put to use as an ongoing new business, if you will.
I had one question perhaps you could clear up for me. There's an indication that Mr. Hawes resigned before there was an asset transfer. There was some indication that was the case, and he didn't participate in the drafting of the transfer agreement, and he really didn't learn about it until after the fact. Does that have any effect?
Well, I think that does have an effect, because if you postulate for purposes of today that the firm was insolvent in some way, and the directors become equitable trustees over the corporate assets for the benefit of creditors,
mm-hmm.
The action that they allege violated that role as trustee or that duty was paying the corporate attorneys. And I guess not preferring another creditor, Ms. Pompey, to their own attorneys. That occurred by virtue of the asset sale. And by the time that act occurred, Mr. Hawes was no longer a director. If he wasn't a director, he wasn't a trustee, an equitable trustee, even under the trust fund doctrine, whether or not there's insolvency. Doesn't matter. And their claim against my clients for fiduciary duty is basically that by virtue of representing the equitable trustee under the trust fund theory, which I guess has to be Mr. Reith, my clients, ergo, had some kind of vicarious fiduciary duty of their own directly to their client's former litigation adversary, the judgment creditor, and had to get out of the way and forego being paid to basically let her attorneys get paid first. That's what this is really, in effect, about. Now, the key thing here, though, Judge, is, Your Honor, there is no evidence whatsoever that my clients represented Mr. Hawes individually at all, or that they represented Mr. Reith in any capacity other than as the broker in the underlying case. Yes, there were communications with him because they represented the corporation, and the only people they can talk to, of course, are the directors. But as the Wade case makes clear, representing a corporate entity does not equate with representing shareholders, directors, or officers as individuals or in those capacities. So that's the linchpin that this entire house of cards depends upon. And you don't need to adopt the trust fund theory, reject the trust fund theory, figure out whether to allow judgment creditors to bring derivative actions against their former, against their judgment debtor's former litigation counsel and all these complex issues because of that very thing. With respect to that.
Are you saying that, essentially what I'm getting is you're telling me it doesn't matter whether or not the corporation was solvent or insolvent before the asset transfer, and that the determination, from what I understand, wasn't made?
The determination wasn't asked for, is our position, and they can't ask for it now if they didn't ask for it below. So that's the first problem. But no, I don't think it matters whether or not the company was insolvent, because Mr. Hawes was no longer a director and therefore not a trustee, even under this argument. At the time of the transfer, Mr. Reith was still a director, and if he became an equitable trustee, there's no evidence my clients represented him as a director or an equitable trustee or a statutory trustee or in any other capacity as a broker in the underlying case and as just a person to speak to on behalf of the corporation that they represented. The one case I have you, Your Honors, really examine in connection with the Rule 23 issue, I'm sorry, the fiduciary duty issue, they focus on Wilners. And in that Wilners case, a creditor was allowed to sue derivatively the corporation's attorney. However, in that case, the attorney had acquired and held on to corporate assets partly to pay his own fee, which was not the problem, but then dispersing those assets or distributing those assets to the director to the derogation of the creditor's rights. That didn't occur here. It was just a payment to a bona fide creditor. And the McDermott case out of California explains that even though in many trust fund states there's no direct right of action against the director, there's no direct right of action against anyone because the trust arises for the benefit of all creditors. It's got to be a derivative type action. Rule 23.1 was completely ignored here. There's no nominal plaintiff in the form of Premier, Inc. or its trustees. There was no demand on the board or the trustees. There was no allegation of demand futility. They ignored 23.1. And even if you believe that you can bring a derivative creditor action, if you take a look at the McDermott case out of the California Court of Appeals case in 2000, they said that procedurally it makes sense to allow a creditor derivative a shareholder derivative action, even just a shareholder derivative action. But because of attorney-client privilege concerns, the court barred that action because the attorney could not defend him or herself because he owed confidentiality obligations to the corporate client that not even a derivative shareholder suing had the right to waive. And certainly a creditor in a derivative setting can't waive that either. The attorneys can't defend themselves, and that's why that court said, we're just not going to allow this.
Okay. Period. Thank you for your argument.
Thank you very much.
If you could answer my question about the money that's been received by your client yourself.
In terms of the actual dollar amount, Your Honor, I'm not sure. Unfortunately, that's a little above my pay grade. Certainly, the firm has been paid some money. Absolutely. We have not been paid, or the firm has not been paid anywhere near to the amount it has incurred or earned in the case, but I guess I would say, Your Honor, that whether or not my firm or the firm I work for has been paid, is kind of irrelevant here. If we'd been paid in full and had a $50,000 retainer on the books, there would still be the issue of whether the Clarkson defendants committed malpractice against their client, Old Premier.
And what are your issues affect to deny the summary judgment if you were to write the opinion here or the order?
As to the malpractice claim?
As to anything that would overcome the summary judgment.
The first and foremost is the finding of insolvency that wasn't there, which was front and center as one of the undisputed statements of fact in our moving papers on summary judgment below. It was certainly raised. I don't know how I can raise it more than stating it as an undisputed statement of material fact. So there needs to be a finding of fact that Old Premier was insolvent prior to the asset transfer. The second thing is Haas's directorship. They've certainly presented their facts, and that's fine. They'll be able to present them to the jury. But number one, Haas admitted in his own pleadings that he was a director of Old Premier at the time of the structuring and discussions and carrying out of the asset transfer. Two, he testified that he was a director of Old Premier from the beginning to the end, and you know, appellees can take issue with that to the jury if they want. And third, when discussing this third-party offer for Old Premier, Mr. Reith responded to the offer and said, well, you know what, I have to talk to Rick Haas about this and decide what we're going to do. All of that indicates that, you know, whatever their after-the-fact rationalizations are, he was definitely a director at the time that the asset transfer came up. But more to the point, even if Haas is out of the case, Old Premier's malpractice case remains. Because he doesn't need to be a plaintiff. And frankly, I don't think he needs to, or I'm sorry, he doesn't need to be a defendant. And frankly, I don't think he even needs to be a defendant as to the fiduciary duty claims. You don't need to sue one who breaches the fiduciary duty to sue the aider and abettor. They can certainly cross-claim or bring a third-party claim against the primary breacher, but you can sue an aider and abettor on their own. Nevada law is clear on that issue. But nonetheless, that's a finding of material fact that should be reversed. And then the remaining factual findings regarding duties owed and whether duties were breached are all fatally flawed as to the malpractice claim, because we're not talking about duties owed to Lori Pompei. These are duties owed to Old Premier by their attorney, Clarkson. And in fact, the game of hot potato that appellees are playing here, which is we didn't represent Reith as a director. We didn't represent Haas as a director, but Old Premier owed us money. Well, number one, when you represent a corporation, you do represent the directors as directors. You don't represent them as individuals, certainly, but there's no other way to represent a corporation other than as directors. And number two, the lack of anyone to bring a claim on an insolvent corporation's behalf is highlighted by this issue. They're all saying we didn't have anything to do with it because we didn't represent the client, and yet the client was the one who was harmed in the asset transfer. And so what we would request is, in addition to reversing those factual findings, that the court adopt these legal doctrines, granting derivative standing to the creditors of insolvent corporations and formally recognizing the trust fund theory, and direct the district court to proceed as to the factual issues in accordance to its new standard or to the appropriate legal doctrine. And I like the analogy that counsel used as to the sinking ship, and I think it really does adequately describe an insolvent corporation. And he's right. You don't have to go down with the ship. But in addition to not pushing people out of the way, you can't sneak off the boat in the life. You can't sneak off the ship in the lifeboat either. And that's exactly what happened here, and it was to Old Premier's detriment, as well as to the creditors of Old Premier, primarily Lori Pompei. And unless there's no questions, I'll rest.
All right, counsel. Thank you for the briefs and the argument today. And this matter will stand submitted, and the court will stand in recess until tomorrow morning.